Okay, and then we'll pick up kind of where we left off. As I read, for those who weren't here, we kind of went through 18, 19, 20, and verses 1 to 7 of the chapter, and I'll make a couple comments as I read them for review. Now Jacob came to Salem, the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram, and he camped before the city. Then he bought a portion of a field where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100, and the Hebrew word is kasita, which again, we don't know what that is. Then he set up there an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Then Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, took her, and lay with her, and defiled her. And he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke to the heart of the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Give me this girl as a wife." Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with the livestock in the field. So Jacob kept silent until they came in. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved. And they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to me as a wife, and intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it, and take possession of property in it." And Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according as you say to me. But give me the girl as a wife." But Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit. And thus they spoke, because he had defiled Dinah their sister. And they said to them, "We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you, if you will become like us, and that every male among you be circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go." Now their words seemed good in the sight of Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more honored than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of the city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, "These men are peaceful with us. Therefore let them live in the land and trade in it. For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters for us as wives and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock and what they acquire and all their cattle be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will live with us." And all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. Now it happened on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the unsuspecting city and killed every male. And they killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went away. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field, and they captured and plundered all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You've brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and strike me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" I'm going to read just a few more verses. Then God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and live there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods which are among you, and cleanse yourselves, and change your garments. And let us arise and go to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and has been with me wherever I have gone." Okay. So we are back in one of the most sordid and painful moments of our father's history. the murder of the men of Shechem by the men of Israel. And it's good that the Bible does not shy away from the wicked failures of God's people. But here is a very grievous error. And I continue to read on to Genesis 35 because I think there's a clue there as to why the brothers act so violently. This is conjecture, but this is what I think. So I'm going to share it. This is a conjecture as to a reason why the sons of Jacob are so violent. When we read in Genesis 35, when God comes to Jacob, then Jacob tells all in his household. Again, remember when we read of households in, especially the book of Genesis, it's more than what we think of as a household. So if we were to say household today, like Nathan's household, well, that'd be Nathan and Callie and all the kids. Or Jay's household, that'd be Jay and Vivi. Right, that's what we think of as household. But remember, in Abraham's household, he had 318 fighting men. Which, some doing the math have said that he could have had up to 2,000 people under his care. Like 1,500 to 2,000 people. And then Isaac would have inherited all of those people under his care, along with his all the people that he gathered to himself. And Jacob, as we know, has sons and daughters. And they have sons and daughters. And he has all the servants that he's acquired, either that have been born in his house, that have been adopted or bought. So Jacob has, his household is much larger than what we think of. And he tells the people that to get rid of the gods that they have among them, the foreign gods. And all of Jacob's house is to get rid of them in chapter 35, verse 2. Now this is not the word, remember when they left Paddan Aram, what Rachel took? Remember that from Laban's house? What were those? Anybody remember those called? The teraphim. Remember that word, the teraphim? That's what Rachel sat on. And when she defiled them by sitting on them. Some of the commentaries that I was reading think that these foreign gods here are the teraphim that Rachel took earlier, that she didn't get rid of them. Well, that could be. It's a possibility, and I don't want to discount that. But that's not the word that's used here. The word that's used here is Nakar Elohim, the foreign gods. I mean, that's really what it says. It's not the teraphim, but it could be the teraphim. I don't want to discount that out of hand. But perhaps these are the household idols that once populated Laban's tents, even though the word teraphim is not used. But I think it's brought out immediately after the murder of all of these men of Shechem, because the root of the brothers' violence lies in their worship of idols. They have over-the-top violence. It's what they do here is commensurate with what we would see their grandfather Laban doing. Remember, Jacob leaves. He packs up his household. He didn't take anything that was Laban's. Well, he didn't know that Rachel took the teraphim. So aside from that, nothing that Jacob had in his possession belonged to Laban. And Laban set out with all of his men of war to catch up to Jacob and to take all that stuff away from him. Like, this is how Laban's act in the world. This is not how the sons of Jacob are supposed to act. And I think it shows, and this again shows a parallel to the book of Exodus, as we saw last week. Remember, you come out from under the oppressor, Laban or Egypt. You encounter Edomites or Amalekites on the way to Sukkot. You get to Mount Sinai or to Salem, where you have peace with God and your people. And then the covenant people of God are judged for having idols. So here we have the foreign gods in Genesis 35. And after they come to Mount Sinai, they're in Exodus 32. They build the golden calf. They build a foreign god. God liberated them and defeated all of the gods of Egypt, but the people never left their idolatries behind. That's what's happening here. We actually find out in Joshua 24, verse 14, that the reason the Israelites were made slaves in Egypt is because they worshiped foreign gods, the same word that's used here in Genesis 35. And when people begin to worship other gods, the effect is that of cruelty. Because Paul, as Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 18 to 20, the statue itself, an idol is indeed lifeless, but the reality behind the idol, Paul says, is a demon. And when people are worshiping idols, they become like what they worship. So if you have foreign gods in your midst, but Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 10, what you're really doing is you're messing around with demonic forces. And every we know this from history. You know, every civilization apart from those who've become Christian have been characterized by cruelty. Not to say there aren't cruel people in Christian nations, there are. But a civilization that's characterized by Christ and His Spirit will seek to not be cruel. As we saw on Sunday, remember the stumbling block law. You're not allowed in God's nation, you're not allowed to trip a blind person. And that limits the cruelty that men will do to one another. Part of the reason, so what we have in Genesis 34 is covenantal fratricide, brother-brother murder. And apart from the lopsided and exaggerated revenge, is that the brothers, the sons of Jacob, are worshiping foreign gods that twist their perception of reality. So they think that Shechem fornicating with Dinah meant that they could murder him and all the men in the city as a form of justice. But that's demonic. That's satanic. Fratricide is satanic. If you go back to Genesis chapter 4, I get you guys, that was very recent that we were in Genesis 4. So you should all remember my lectures on Genesis 4. Right, Greg? Mm-hmm. Greg never forgets anything I say.
I have my notebook.
Good. Where is it? Okay. So remember, Cain and Abel come to the gate of Yahweh at the Garden of Eden. Cain's sacrifice is not accepted, but Abel's is. And we read, so Cain became very angry, and his countenance fell. And Yahweh said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is lying at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. And you guys remember my hypothesis on that phrase, is that the thing lying at the door, at the gate of the Garden of Eden, in the courtroom of God, where He meets with His people, is the serpent. And if you use your imagination, reading Genesis 4, and Cain, who's about to be overwhelmed by sin, God says, use your imagination, sin's lying at the door. Well, what's there? And my conjecture was that He's talking about the serpent. And he must overcome the serpent, or else the serpent will overcome him. Which he doesn't overcome sin, he doesn't overcome the bitterness in his heart. He gives himself, what we would say in the New Testament, like with the language of Judas, he gives himself over to Satan, and what we find is fratricide. Same thing that happens to Jesus. When Judas gives himself over to Satan, brother kills brother. Okay? Judas greets Jesus with a brotherly kiss and leads him to be murdered. Cain does not overcome sin that was lying at the door, the serpent. And because he didn't overcome that sin, the dragon, Satan, he murders his brother. And what we find in Genesis 34 is that Jacob's sons make a covenant. They allow these people to all join the church, their covenant brothers, and then they murder them. And the very next thing we read is that they're populated with worshiping foreign gods. Right? I don't think that's an accident. Just a side note in the text. I think it's there on purpose. If you start worshiping other gods, you're going to end up biting and devouring one another. I think that's what's going on there. The cruelties are magnified in the generation of Jacob's sons because of the idolatry that fuels it. Now remember that what happened between Dinah and Shechem is not forced rape. It was the sin of fornication. Shechem convinced her to do it, which is sinful, of course. But Dinah still did it, and he did not force her to do it. That's not the language that's used in the text. We looked at that last week. Some study Bibles and some commentaries take this as an episode of rape, but as I pointed out last time we met, the text doesn't support that. However, because some take it that way, they look at verse 26, for example. So if you look at verse 26, and they, that is the brothers, killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went away. And because some people interpret this whole episode as forced rape, and then they also say that Hamor, Shechem, and Jacob are bartering over Dinah and treating her like a piece of meat, and Dinah is in Shechem's house as a captive and a hostage, a sex slave, that the brothers are justified in liberating her and killing all the men in the city. You guys think I have weird interpretations. Yes, Jay?
Verse 2 to 34, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated. He seized her and humiliated.
Right.
That sounds like great to me.
Well, that's yours. You can eat that. Well, the word seized is took. So Isaac took Rebecca. That's the same word.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And he lay with her. He humiliated her. He defiled her. Language today would be that he deflowered her. Right? He took away her virginity, but it wasn't forced rape. It's a different scenario than what we read in 2 Samuel 13 with Amnon and Tamar. That is the words that are used there, the verbs that are used there, are the verbs for forceful rape. What's used here is for fornication. And what we find, what I mentioned last week, is that Shechem actually comes to Jacob to uphold the law of God. So in the book of Exodus, when a young couple fornicates, the young man is to go to the father and ask permission to marry her. And the father has the right to say yes or no. And that's exactly what Shechem does. Right? Yes, does your heading there at the beginning of chapter 34 say the rape of Dinah?
The defiling.
And defiling is a fine word. An unmarried virgin, right, who has intercourse is defiled, is deflowered, is humiliated. And the way that she can have her glory back is to marry that man. Which is what Tamar, remember in the Amnon and Tamar, it's the complete opposite. He forces himself upon her. He ends up despising her in his heart, where Shechem cleaves to her. He doesn't want to marry her. He forces her out of the house, locks the door behind her, and she's wailing through the streets, talking about all the shame and humiliation that she has, and no one will marry her now because she's been defiled. But here we have something different. This is the sin of fornication with two young folk. I related it last time to a young Christian girl being duped by a good-looking pagan. And they made a sinful mistake, but the good-looking pagan dude, he wants to make it right. So he goes to his dad, he goes to her dad, and he's willing to marry her. And he even says, my soul cleaves to her, I love her, I'll do anything that you want me to do, let me marry her.
Right.
Right, it wasn't an act of violence. Because there's, like with the incident with Tamar, it's very clearly an act of violence from all the verbs and from Tamar's reaction. And here we find that Dinah is with Shechem with Shechem the whole time. I don't think that she's in his house as a captive. I think she's in his house because they're married. Remember the text says he did not hesitate to do the thing because he loved her so much. He's like, yep, we're doing it. And then she went home with him. That's my interpretation. But some of the commentators in Bible studies that I read, they see this as that forceful act. They see this as Dinah being taken captive and hostage so Jacob can increase his wealth and possessions. Like he's using her. And the brothers rightfully go in then and slaughter the men of the city and take their sister back. And they say, and the commentators say, Shechem deserved it and so did all of his people. Wow. You really have to think Jacob's a scumbag to get to that point. And I just don't think that's what's going on here. So, John? Right. Yeah, if they were going in justified to rescue her, then why would Jacob respond the way that he did? Yeah, that's a good question. So, I think Shechem is a young man who drew a crooked line, but he goes to his daddy and he goes to her daddy and he's willing to do whatever it takes to make it straight. Right? And that's good. And the issue now is how is the church going to receive this scenario? It's something that's bad, but are they going to overcome evil with good or with evil? And the church has a wonderful opportunity. This is the first time that the word Israel is used. If you look in the text, when the sons of Jacob are grieved, they say this thing ought not to be done in Israel. This is the first time it's used as a collective noun for the people of God. And so it sets up a scenario as how is Israel as a nation going to respond to another nation that wants to join them. Sure, it came about through a bad scenario, but how that happens all the time. Bad scenarios happen all the time in the church. How is the church going to respond? Overcome this evil with good, or make it worse by adding evil to evil? And the brothers, they fail. That's how I see it. In verse 5, Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob kept silent until they came in. This is another thing where the commentators say Jacob is abdicating. Jacob is silent because this is a daughter of Leah, and he hates Leah, so it doesn't really matter to him. All sorts of things like that. But I made the argument last time that he's waiting for the brothers to come back from shepherding because the brothers are the ones who negotiate the bride price, as we've seen a few times in Genesis. Remember when Abraham's servant Eliezer goes to Bethuel's household to find a wife for Isaac? He doesn't deal with Bethuel, he deals with Laban, the brother. Jacob goes and deals with Laban and the brothers of Rachel and Leah. The brothers are the ones who deal with marriage negotiations. He's not abdicating, but he's also setting up a scenario in which his sons can grow and learn wisdom. So they have an international relations incident, right? And as a burgeoning young nation, how are they going to handle it? It's an opportunity to grow in wisdom, but they don't. So Jacob is the one who grew in wisdom in all of his hard circumstances. Every time evil came against Jacob, he came out on top by being faithful to God and to those around him in messy circumstances. So how will his sons do? In verses 8 to 10, Hamor is offering Jacob dominion in the land of Canaan. Now this is the way that you overcome sinful Canaanites before God gives you the decree to kill them all. And so remember, the iniquity of the Amorites is not fulfilled yet. They don't have the decree from God to go in and kill all of the Canaanites. But God has promised to Abraham and his descendants that the land would become theirs. So how are you going to do that? Well, you convert them. And this is an opportunity for that. One question that some of the commentators bring up that is an interesting one is, how come in the text Shechem and Hamor do not apologize? They don't apologize for what Shechem did. And we have to say, well, they might have, because this is only part of the, I'm sure much more was talked about. You know, I mean, if Jacob has a couple thousand people, I mean, just think of all the conversations he could have with Hamor about ruling. Like, hey, how are you doing with all your sheep in the field? And, oh, yeah, I got, you know, like two dads talking about how hard it is to rule over people. Like, there's tons of stuff they could have talked about. It's just not recorded here. And from the attitude of these two men coming to Jacob, I would assume they did apologize. It's just not the focus of the text. The focus of the text is that these Gentiles want in, right? The defilement of Dinah, not that it's not sinful and it's not grievous, but it's incidental to, I think, what the focus of the text is. The focus of the text is how Israel is going to incorporate Gentiles. That's what I think the focus is. And it comes about through the incident with Dinah. And that's what is going on here, I think. So maybe they did apologize, but what we read in the text, we just don't know. And some think that Dinah's not present for this conversation, that she's held back at Shechem's house hostage, or that the men are using her as a bartering tool to get more stuff. But I don't see why she wouldn't be there. I assume she's there. She's a willing participant to the marriage proposition. She walked into that fornication willfully. She's with Shechem. And nothing is ever said like, and Dinah refused to go. Or they liberated Dinah from the house of Shechem. Or there's nothing like that. Again, this is most modern commentators. A lot of other commentators in church history don't see Jacob as a bad guy. But a lot of modern ones do. And then that colors the way they interpret what's going on here. But what's at stake is not the safety of Dinah, but the conversion and inclusion of the Gentiles into the covenant of peace. But the sons of Jacob are in danger of destroying the covenant and ruining the witness of Israel to the nations around them. And that's what Jacob's concerned about. The whole point of the covenant is to bless the nations, but the sons of Jacob, the new nation of Israel, are using the covenant of peace as a pretext for murder. That's the bigger sin. And when you think about, so if this isn't fornication and not rape, what could Jacob do? Right? The young couple come to Dad Hamor and to Dad Jacob, and they say, "We messed up. We're going to get married." Like, how can Jacob exercise any sort of judgment because on that situation, aside from either saying yes or no? It's a sin that happened. There's no crime that's attached to it. There's no civil punishment for this. Because they'll say Jacob's abdicating from his responsibilities. But the commentators never say what he should do. What do you do? I mean, they both seem to be repentant. It's not like he's going to excommunicate Dinah. They're like, "Oh, you fornicated once and you want to marry the guy? Oh, and he wants to convert? No." Jacob doesn't act that way. So I don't know what they're expecting from him. But again, that's not what I think the focus is here. If Dinah is around 15, 16 years old, as I argued last time, then her oldest brothers are nearing the age of 30, and they may have daughters and sons of their own that are nearing the age to be married off. So Jacob could also have other daughters that we don't know about. But the sons of God, are the sons of God supposed to marry the daughters of men? So this is part of the deal. Like, you guys marry with us, we'll marry with you. But are the sons of God supposed to marry the daughters of men? Well, the answer is no. We learned that back in Genesis chapter 6. When members of the covenant intermarry with pagans, the faith becomes corrupt and God floods the whole world, only finding one family to save. But what if the daughters of men are converted and become members of the covenant? Well, then the problem of Genesis 6 is solved. Right? Then we wouldn't call them the daughters of men anymore. It seems like a good thing that's happening here. And, yep. It'd be hard for you to convince me to circumcise myself for some sheep.
It would be what?
Hard for you to convince me to circumcise myself for some sheep.
But isn't that what this says?
I know, so why would they do it? And why would an entire city do it? Right, that in my mind is a miraculous act of God, where an entire city full of adult men agree to be circumcised to be at one people with Israel. Right, that's miraculous.
But the text says, like, when he's trying to convince the people of the city.
Oh, sure. Well, he's just telling them the truth. If we become one people with them, their stuff becomes our stuff, and our stuff becomes their stuff. It's exactly what they say to Jacob and to his sons. There's no lying or deceiving or cheating going on. The same things that Shechem and Hamor say in the city gates are the same things that Jacob and his sons had said to them. That's what they said. If you circumcise, we will be one people. Your daughters will be ours, our daughters will be yours, your stuff will be ours, our stuff will be yours. There's no difference between the...
Is that an odd thing to say with somebody like, when you be baptized and join our church and our stuff will be yours and your stuff will be ours?
Well, if somebody came into the church and was baptized... Sure. Well, remember... Remember also verses 18 to 20 before this in Genesis 33. Jacob set up an altar, so a public place of worship called El Elohe Israel, the God or the mighty God of Israel. And he set this up at Salem in Shechem, a public place of worship, for 15 years. And we even read that the people say, Hamor and Shechem come to the people of the city and they say, "These people have been at peace with us." That people, they know who they are. I mean, you're out there shepherding with these people for 15 years. You've got thousands of people with you. You got a big church, right? And you're doing public worship. Yahweh's the true God, that kind of worship. They know who these guys are. And the men of the city say, "Let's do it." Like, I guess I'm reading it generously. Right? This isn't as black and white, like, "Oh, this is exactly like Nineveh." Right? Well, I don't think it's exactly like Nineveh or as clear as Nineveh. But I think this is an introduction of Gentiles converting into the faith in a miraculous way. So if a young guy in the church came to all of these older guys in the church and said, "Hey, I want to marry this girl, but for me to do it, you all have to be circumcised." We would say, "No way, Jose." And that's your own problem. But all the men in the city go, "Yes." Like, that to me, that is a miraculous thing. And could some of them be in it for selfish gain? Well, sure. The brothers themselves set this up for their selfish gain. Right? I don't. So there probably are some bad apples, in the city of Shechem, for sure. But that wouldn't prevent us to say a family of 14 comes to the church, and they've got grandma and grandpa that live with them too, and they're just brand new converts, right? And they've got 14 kids. So there's mom and dad, 14 kids, that's 16. And then you got grandma and grandpa live with them, that's 18. And they all agree to be baptized. What would we do? Well, we baptize them all. And they'd become members of the church. Could there be a bad apple in there? Well, yeah. Right? Right. No, I'm just saying, and when people come in into the covenant, there's never there's no membership class or grand test of faith. Prove your faith to us before we accept you. If they want in, we let them in. And then you disciple them. I'm reading this very generously. I admit to that, yeah. And could some of the men of Shechem be out after selfish gain? Well, sure. But convincing a whole city of men to do it, wow. Like, I don't know how you would do that. So, good question, though. I don't know if I satisfied it with that answer. Well, that's why I want to move chapter 34, the big 3-4, I want to move that up 3 verses. Because I think it should start at verse 18. Because it's part of the context of what happens here at Shechem. Jacob's been worshiping there publicly. He set up the church. We would say today, Jacob is he planted a church and his mission is the city of Shechem. And he's been there for 15 years. Like, guys like Caleb's dad. Right, Caleb's dad plants a church in a city. In 15 years, everyone there is going to know him. Right? So, anyway. Especially if you're the only church in town. Callie? No, I don't know. And when we get to the murder of all these guys, we'll talk more about that. Like, how could you... Because we read Simeon and Levi go in and do it. And the assumption is that they bring their men with them. However many men they have. But still, you would think, if Greg and Alan go out and fight a city, I don't think it's as big as Helena, but if they go out and fight a city, even men who've been circumcised 3 days before, if there's enough of you, you could stop a couple dudes, right? So we'll talk about that when we get to Genesis 34. I have 3 parts of. We'll get to that and consider some options of how this happened. So I think the daughters of men are willing to convert and join the covenant. The sons of men are going to become sons of God. And it seems like a good thing. They want the treasure, and so I'm sure that some people, like I said, are going to join the covenant out of greed. That shouldn't surprise us. That's happened throughout church history. Those are the kinds of people that want the treasure of the kingdom, we would say, but not the blessings of the kingdom. They'll join a church to get good business relationships, but they don't want anything to do with righteousness or faithfulness. And yeah, I'm sure that's present here. But would this marriage arrangement here be a good thing or a bad thing according to God's law? The law later says that Israel is not permitted to marry Canaanites nor to make covenant with them at all, but that commandment is still 300 to 400 years away. And like I said, the iniquity of the Amorites hasn't been filled up yet. And we read, for example, in Genesis 14, verse 13, that Abraham makes covenants with Canaanites, and there's no problem with that. So I think it's okay. God has not said yet, kill all of them. Okay? And we should also recognize that the patriarchs up to this point, so some of what I've read, that this shouldn't happen. There shouldn't even be propositions of marriage because all these people are uncircumcised. Well, we should recognize that all the patriarchs up to this point have married women from uncircumcised households. So, Abraham was obviously not circumcised when he married Sarah. Sarah did not come from a circumcised household. Rebekah came from Bethuel's household, and he wasn't circumcised. Rachel and Leah came from Laban's household, and Laban wasn't circumcised. You know, so to chastise the patriarchs for saying, hey, you shouldn't have set up this marriage proposition with the Canaanites. Well, they've been doing this kind of thing all along. The thing is conversion into the covenant. The thing is conversion into the covenant. The women were willing, those women who married the patriarchs were willing to join the covenant. They became sisters in the covenant so that they could marry. So if Shechem is willing to convert, then the marriage is no problem at all. And it should have happened. So if God, so this isn't like an obedience issue, this is a wisdom issue. It's not a black and white obedience. If God had said earlier to the patriarchs, never marry a Canaanite, just no qualifications, then Jacob would have said, we can't do that. But God never said that. Yahweh says that you are permitted to marry converts. It's messy, there's lots of potential problems, and they'd have to deal with it wisely. Jacob has to deal with difficult scenarios with wisdom all the time. And now he's giving his sons, the new leaders of Israel, the opportunity to learn that wisdom by navigating a difficult situation. But they won't be wise. Instead, they'll be fools. And we'll have to wait in the text for Joseph. Remember, Joseph is in Egypt at this point. We'll have to wait for Joseph to be the son to show us wisdom among the Gentiles. Joseph is the son who does that. Verses 11 to 12, we have Shechem proclaiming his great love and cleaving to Dinah. And he says, I'm paraphrasing, you can bankrupt me for the dowry if you want to. Remember that word mohar? Anybody remember that word? The bride price? Anybody remember what the mohar, the bride price, who that goes to? It goes to the bride. He's the prince of the city, and he says, ask the dowry, the bride price, name it, bankrupt me. And the bride price goes to Dinah. Right? This isn't Jacob getting more money. Which some of the commentators say, oh, Jacob just wants the riches of Shechem for himself. Well, no, it would all go to Dinah. That's what the mohar is. That's what the bridal price is. It's her money. And when you take a step back, you know, dads, right? Dads with daughters. What more could you ask from a punk like this? Right? I mean, he admits his wrong. He wants to join the church. And he's willing to do whatever it takes to make sure that that girl will be his and no one else's. Right? You might not like, of course we don't like what he did. He ought not to have done it. But what more can you ask for? He's willing to do whatever it takes to have Dinah his wife. It's a good attitude. But to the brothers here, there's nothing that Shechem can do to make it right. Or that would ever be good enough. One commentator I read suggests that the brothers' rage, and this is psychologizing the text, but I think it's insightful. He suggests that the brothers' rage is because they feel guilty for not having protected their sister. Right? That's why they react this way. They overreact to compensate for their own guilty consciences. They've already sold Joseph off into slavery, and now this happens. And they have to have an outlet. They need, we would say, a scapegoat. Perhaps. That's psychologizing a text. It doesn't say that, but we have all experienced things like that. But when the vengeance of man comes forward in history, it's never a good thing. Justice is good and right, but vengeance is the Lord's, and we should trust God with it when we have no recourse. And when you look at the text, vengeance really is the Lord's. I'll explain that in just a second. The brothers speak to Hamor and Shechem, and the text is very plain about their intentions in verses 13 and 19. It shows us the wicked deception of Israel. Remember, from Genesis 3 forward, deception has been going on all the time in the book of Genesis. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. For example, when you're dealing with tyrants, the wicked rulers who hold all the cards, they've got all the power, the only thing you can do is to stay alive is to deceive them. And that's okay in the Bible. It's wrong to lie if you have no reason to do so. It's wrong to lie so that you can do something wrong. It's wrong to lie to cover up your sin. It's wrong to lie, to deny the Lord. So if a wicked tyrant comes to you and says, hey, are you a Christian? And you've been hearing me teach about, you know, righteous uses of deception. If you say no, that is not righteous. You never deny the Lord. You don't do that to stay alive. We did a lecture on deception and lying in the Bible And if you have your notes like Greg, you can go back and look at that to refresh your memory. You know, and I use the classic example when the Nazis come to your door and they say, "Do you have Jews here?" It's okay for you to say no. I don't have them in my attic. I don't have them in my cellar. I don't have any Jews here. Because they don't deserve the truth. So those kinds of lies are okay in the Bible. If you have to preserve life against the wicked by lying, that's okay. But you do not lie to preserve your life for martyrdom. You never deny the Lord. When you deny the Lord or deny your identity, what happens is what we find in the book of Esther, that the whole covenant is jeopardized. Remember, the king Ahasuerus had no idea that Esther was a Jew. And the whole covenant people of God were jeopardized and were going to be put to death by Agag the Amalekite. And all their fortunes changed when she said, "I'm a Jew." And then they conquered their enemies and won the day. So you never deny the Lord. But is that what Simeon and Levi are doing here? Are they using deception, like I've talked about, in a good way? Are they using deception to escape from the looming death of tyrants? No, they are lying. They're the wicked ones. They're using deception to attack someone else. They have all the cards. The sons of Jacob are the tyrants here. They are the wicked ones using deception as power to get what they want from someone in a weaker position. Shechem says, "I'll do whatever you want." And what the brothers do is they use deception in a satanic way. Simeon and Levi hold all the cards, and they use deception for more wickedness. And like I said, some commentators are okay with the brothers' actions, but then there's always like a sentence, "But they shouldn't have lied about circumcision." It's like, oh, murder's okay. But you're going to get them on the lying about circumcision. They'll say, like I said, Shechem deserves death for what he did to Dinah, which, not according to God's law, he doesn't. And if Shechem, their prince, deserves to die, so do all his people. But I just can't go there. I don't think that's what the text teaches. The sons of Jacob, rather, the leaders of Israel, are now the tyrants in the book of Genesis. So where's Reuben in all this would be another good question, because Reuben is the firstborn son of Leah. Remember Simeon and Levi? They're negotiating because they're the full-blooded brothers of Dinah. So they have preeminence in negotiating the marriage of their sister. Where's Reuben? He's the oldest. Why isn't he involved? This is reading back into the text from what we know later. But remember when they want to kill Joseph, Reuben is the one who says, no. We can't kill them. This is how I imagine the scenario. You know, using your imagination. He's like, no, don't kill him. Let's sell him. Right? Like, he's doing anything he can to appease the wrath of the brothers and keep Joseph alive. Reuben doesn't have the stomach for this kind of stuff. And perhaps he doesn't have the stomach for what's going on here. Perhaps he's there, but the text isn't highlighting him because he's not partaking in the evil deeds of Simeon and Levi. You know, so perhaps Reuben is thinking, these guys should get circumcised and join the covenant. Yeah, that's right. Where Simeon and Levi are the ones saying it for deception. Again, that's reading back into the text and making a lot of assumptions. Reuben might have refused to get involved with the murderous plot. You know, Simeon and Levi could come to all the brothers and be like, "All right, guys, this has been the plan the whole time." And Reuben goes, "I don't think so. Not me." Right. Reuben seems to be that kind of guy. But he should have tried to stop them. Just like he should have refused to sell Joseph. Right? He still capitulates, but anyway. Simeon and Levi want Shechem circumcised because they want to murder him. And in so doing, they forget what circumcision means. Their circumcision meant that they were priests and witnesses of God's covenant of peace to the nations. And they used the circumcision for the exact opposite reason. But it's not only Shechem who's willing to do this, but all the men of the city. The text is very plain that this is just all the adult men. There's nothing said about children here yet. So all the men, it says, who go in and out of the city gates. So these are all the men, all the adults. They agree to do this thing. And these are all the guys who die. All the men in the city. What's going on, I think, is a good thing. But Simeon and Levi ruin it. And now this is what I mean by vengeance is of the Lord. So think about this. Take a step back. Think about this theologically. Shechem's, the young man, Shechem's circumcision is a fulfillment of eye for eye and tooth for tooth justice. The very thing by which he used to deflower Dinah is the very thing which suffers a bloody wound. Does that make sense without being too graphic? Circumcision is God's just punishment for Shechem seducing Dinah. He used his organ of generation, and it gets cut off. Cut off, quote unquote. The wound required of Shechem corresponds to the wound that he gave to Dinah. Right, so this, I think, is it a picture of God's vengeance. God is the one who deals with those kinds of things. Justice is satisfied. But Shechem, justice is satisfied by Shechem being circumcised for deflowering a virgin. And remember, this is the bride price. This is the mohar. And it goes to the bride. So I don't think he handed anything to her. But the imagery is that the bride price is that part of Shechem because of what Shechem did to her. Am I making sense? I'm trying not to be too gratuitous in my language here. But I think on a big picture scale, when we think vengeance is the Lord's, how does the Lord bring vengeance in history? Well, here's one way. And the brothers should see that. Right? This is working out for the good. God has got this under control. Verses 19 to 24. The elders, the leaders of the city, reside in the city gates. We see that all through the Bible. This is where decisions of who can enter the city, who has to pay taxes, who can stay in the city, who has to get kicked out of the city, all the verdicts of guilt and innocence, all the contracts take place, like in the book of Ruth. Remember when Boaz wants to marry Ruth? He makes this contract when the elders sit down in the city gates. All that stuff happens there. They decide who can enter the city, and all sorts of things like that. Who's excommunicated from the city, who can't come in. And like I said earlier, the men of the city, we would expect, would have nothing to do with this. You better put the gold and the sheep and the cattle in my hand before I take a flint to myself. Just, I've got enough sheep, thanks very much. And my wife and I are satisfied. You're like, ew. That would be, at least I would assume, the reaction of most men. But the men of the city all go along with this. And really, when you think about it, it's a lame appeal. You have a whole city full of people with all the pasture lands all around it that probably most likely outnumber the people of Jacob. And the appeal to this city is, oh, if we do this, we'll get some of their sheep. So take the city of Helena, and we find out that there's a city, let's say, of 5,000 people living up in the hills. And there's Helena, which is what, 40,000 people? How many people are here? 35,000? And somebody comes, to city hall over here, and they say, hey, if we circumcise ourselves, guys, we'll get their sheep. Well, no, that's not enough to worry about. And if we really wanted their sheep, we could just go get them, right? There's enough men here. We could just arm you guys, and we could go take what we want. Jacob is a large group of people, but they're not that big. Jacob even says, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, we are a few in number, and they're going to come and fight us, and we're going to all lose, right? So Jacob's not that powerful. Sorry, Vivian, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, a large part of it was their daughters as wives.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, hopefully. Well, Christian girls are good looking, so. Why'd you laugh at that? Yeah. Hey, find me anywhere in the world that has more beautiful women than Christian churches. Just saying. So yeah, you're right, Vivian. They want those gems, that's for sure. But if they wanted the stuff, they could have just taken it. If they wanted the sheep, they could just take it. I think the point of what's going on here is not the selfishness of the men of Shechem. That could be... Point granted, I'm sure there were selfish men there, but their willingness to convert and join the covenant people of God. And if the men of Shechem and their households are blessed for joining the covenant, what's wrong with that? I remember I was reading one commentator, and he's pointed out we shouldn't attribute selfish motives here necessarily, because there's nothing wrong with receiving good things for doing good things. And I thought, that's true enough. that's how we raise our kids, you know. When they are full of obedience and honor mom and dad, we praise them, we bless them, you know, give them a little treat. Like, you guys did good today, you know. There's nothing wrong with receiving good things for doing good things. And we shouldn't always attribute selfish motives to it. But again, the text, you know where I stand on it, but I'm willing to be persuaded. And Israel should not worry either, because they should have learned from Jacob's history that if God wants you to lose all of your possessions, there's nothing you can do about it. Right? You could have a household of thousands of people. You could have the promised inheritance. You could be promised the line of the Messianic covenant. And you can end up in the wilderness with a stick. That's what happened to Jacob. But if he wants to bless you with enormous wealth, and sheep, and cattle, and servants, and children, he can do that too, even when Laban's against you. Right? The sons of Israel should not have worried at all. Simeon and Levi do not trust God for much of anything, but rather by their wicked deceptions from their own minds and the murderous strength of their own arms, they will nearly bring the covenant to ruin, and they will kill all the adult men of an entire city. I compared this like last week, or 2 weeks, last week. You know, like a Baptist missionary goes and starts a church and for 15 years ministers outside of a village, and suddenly all the men of the village convert, and then he drowns them in baptism. Next, you destroy the covenant. You ruin the witness of the church in the world. The whole affair with Shechem was working out to be a very good thing as a budding nation of Israel, and they had an opportunity to deal wisely and peacefully with one of the nations of the world, the first nation who wanted in, and Israel failed. So, let us learn from their errors. Any questions tonight? Next week we'll finish the chapter and look at next couple weeks. I think next week might be Psalm Sing. I don't even know what day it is. Greg?
Why were they so, if half of Helena came knocking on our church door and said, hey, we want to join your church, why do you think they were so hesitant to bring Gentile outside, people in? Why do you think they were so?
Why do I think who was hesitant?
The sons of Jacob.
Oh, because they wanted revenge. I don't think they wanted people to join the covenant. They wanted revenge. Remember, they weren't just worshiping Yahweh. They were worshiping other gods.
So, the sons.
What's that?
The sons.
The sons, right. Yeah, so I don't think the evangelism and the peace of the nations, the Abrahamic covenant, the promises of the Abrahamic covenant, were in their minds, like what I'm talking about. The text is presenting. This is what should be in their minds. But what is rather in their minds is a way to murder these people. And the way they do that is by making them covenant brothers. So they extend the covenant, the Abrahamic covenant of peace to a nation, the first nation to do it. And instead of welcoming them in peace, making a bad situation into a good one, they go from bad to worse by using the covenant of peace as a tool of murder, fratricide. They're acting like Cain.
I mean, I understand where you're saying all the males that went in and out of the gate, everyone uh-huh. that went in and out of the gate. But when it says they went and killed, it says they went and killed all the males.
Well, then and I would refer that back to all the males who went in and out of the gate, because then it also says they took their children, not just their daughters. It took the kids. Yeah. Which is the neuter noun for like kids, not just daughters. So I think they took the boys, they took the little girls. So they were doing warfare, harem warfare, but God never commissioned them to do it. And they did it. And remember, I brought this up last week, when Joshua entered the promised land and he was deceived into making a covenant with a group of Canaanites, and all of Israel was mad at him about it. And they said, well, let's go get them. And Joshua said, no one touches them. Right, the Gibeonites. I think Joshua probably had this story in mind. Like, he learned from the sons of Jacob. Well, they're members of the covenant now. until they force themselves out or they do something to get kicked out, we can't touch them. They're brothers and sisters. So I think Joshua probably learned from this story here on how to relate to nations who want to join the covenant and how to treat them. And that's how we would treat a household that comes in to be baptized into the church. We would treat them as brothers and sisters until they proved otherwise. Right? We don't just kick them out or we find out later, like Rahab, you were once a prostitute. You can't be here. You don't get to act that way anymore. Right? We can't kick somebody out for once being a prostitute. Right? So I think those are the kinds of principles we can learn from this. And again, like our method of bringing people into the church here means that there's potentially a lot of work on the other end. So you bring in a family that is brand new to the church, and they're baptized into the church, and they're welcomed as brothers and sisters. There's going to be a lot of growing pains with that. Rather than setting up, well, you have to come to Bible class and membership class for a year before you can become members. You know, we want you in, then we'll raise you. And that's something the elders are willing to take the burden of, is that kind of growth and maturation, that kind of trouble. Because I'm sure there would be a lot of trouble, quote-unquote, dealing with the men, the covenant men of Shechem. You know, if Jacob's sons were righteous, they would go into Shechem and be like, guys, you can't do that anymore. You know, can't trip blind people. We'll use a light, humorous example. How did I get on that? I probably didn't answer your question.
I asked about killing males.
Killing males.
Because if they,
oh, sorry.
If they did kill all the males, then it would be, you know how at the time of Christ, Israel had swapped places and had become Egypt.
Right.
By that time.
Yeah.
How that if they did kill all the males, or even, I mean, all the males, how that would be 10 times worse than Pharaoh or Herod. And they flip it around.
Right.
Because they just killed the young males.
Pharaoh, and then Herod. Yeah, and Herod was just, he relegated his murder to one city, to Bethlehem. Yeah, so they're at good point. They're acting here like Egypt. They're acting like Herod. Any other questions or comments? Thanks, Greg. All right, let's stand and pray together. Father and God, we thank you for your word. We're thankful for the witness and the testimony of your people through the history of your church. And we ask that you would help us to learn from this passage of scripture how to deal with those being brought into the church and how to be pastorally wise and to shepherd the immature. We ask, Father, that you would help us to learn from the mistakes of our fathers in the faith so that we might not make them, but rather that we might be a faithful witness to you in the world, bringing the nations to peace. In Jesus' name we ask. Amen. Thanks, everybody.